This is the Brother Trucker Book Club podcast with your host, Graham Bradley, episode 29, Hunting Season. We're going to talk about a series that started out as an independent book sold by a blue-collar guy at his business, kind of as a side thing, I call it an impulse buy. I think he had it at the counter. It became pretty successful, especially for an indie book about 10 years ago. One thing led to another, and it got picked up by sci-fi powerhouse Bain Books, and now it is, let me count them up here, 3, 6, 9, 10, with at least two more to go, books strong, and this year is the 10-year anniversary of the publication of the very first one. But let's get into it, what it is, why I enjoy it, and why I think you might too. Ready, and... I've probably been standing here for 10 minutes talking into my phone, thinking that it was recording, and lo, it was not. So the rundown of the Monster Hunter International series is that it was written by Larry Correa, who at the time, I believe, owned his own gun store. He sold machine guns and everything, and he is himself a huge gun fan and wanted to write a story about a guy who's a gun nut who gets recruited to hunt monsters by a secret organization that takes bounties from the government. If you're unfamiliar with the literary trope of a Mary Sue, I've heard it used in kind of two different contexts. One of them is when you're writing a character who is pretty bland and vapid and basically exists for the reader to project themselves onto that character so that they can pretend that they themselves are in the story. Think Bella Swan from Twilight. Yeah. Or there's another one where it's... kind of like the author just writing a version of themselves where, you know, same interests, same skills, same everything, same physical attributes, and then just writes a fantasy version of their own life. There might be a slightly different term for that, but this is one of the only times I can think of where I read a story that was very obviously like the author writing themselves into something where I didn't care about that because it was... I mean, the action was great. It was a good romp and everything, and the world building was cool, but it was also very strong and solid on the humor. It was like, as long as there's some self-awareness to it, but it's not stopping every five pages, to mock itself as an apology for what it is, that's great. Like, it takes itself just seriously enough to work, but also realizes that it is what it is, and it's just here to have fun. And if there's one thing that I can say is a hallmark of Larry Correa's storytelling, it's that this is a dude who loves what he does. He loves what he writes and he has a ton of fun doing it. So Larry's other bit of background that I've become familiar with over the last decade as I've been reading his books is, aside from being extremely well-versed in gun mechanics and being a competitive shooter and all that, his main background was as an accountant. So the main character in this book in Monster Hunter International, his name is Owen Pitt. He's an accountant with a libertarian streak and he loves guns. So you do the math. He's working late one night, finds out that his boss is in the building, and oh, shocker, that his boss is a werewolf. His boss turns into a werewolf, tries to kill him. Owen kills him first, not before he takes some injuries unto himself, and ends up in the hospital. He wakes up, and there are a couple of feds standing over him. They're basically like the Men in Black, but for monsters. They're the Monster Control Bureau. And they tell him, okay, yeah, monsters are real. He tell anybody about it, not only will we disavow, but we'll find you and kill you. He's like, okay, well, yeah, I'm not going to tell anybody. Then he's recruited by this private entity, Monster Hunter International, based in the South, out of Alabama. And they say, hey, you know, there's this thing that the government has called the Perpetual Unearthly Forces Fund. It's basically a slush fund for folk like us that want to get paid to kill monsters. Since you killed a monster, here's your payout for the werewolf. $50,000. Owen's like, yep, I'm going to quit my accountant job and come follow you guys and kill monsters. Doesn't hurt that the boss's daughter is totally smoking hot and Owen wants to date her. And you can see what that part of the interest was. From there, they go into a bit of a boot camp scene where, for the benefit of the reader, your main character learns the ropes, not only about the nature of the business, but the nature of the world itself and the monsters that they're hunting and how much each one is worth. There are your zombies, there are your vampires, there are your werewolves, but there's also weirder stuff out there. Now, the main villain in the first book is the ghost of an old Portuguese conquistador who's trying to find a device that will destroy time. that's bad. They got to put a stop to that. The second book, Monster Hunter Vendetta, still takes place largely in Alabama, but there are side trips to Mexico and New Zealand and so forth. They're dealing with a guy who used to work for MHI who got into some dark magic hoodoo stuff, and there's some airing out of old laundry there. Monster Hunter Alpha, tons of fun, that book. So most of the books are written in the first person from Owen Pitt's perspective, but occasionally another book pops up that is written in third person and from the perspective of another character. This one is from the perspective of Earl Harbinger, who's kind of the boss, one of the bosses at MHI. He's human for the most part. There's a peculiarity to him. You find out what it is in book one, so I'm not going to say what it is because I think you should read it. It's a pretty cool twist. Book three is where you get the backstory on how he became the way that he is and why. And there's, you know, stuff in his past that he's trying to sort out. And it's not just this random side adventure where, oh, I'm dealing with this thing from my past that I didn't tell anybody about. And no, like, there are things that affect his present. There are things that affect other characters. It's, you know, the storytelling is solid in this entire series, I think. And the characters are very well fleshed out. You're drunk, Graham. Go to bed. They're very well fleshed out and realistic, and they've got their own strong personalities, but again, they have their own way of bringing humor to the table, and the humor and the action are the two things that drive this series forward that make each book such a page-turner. Book four, they fight a fear monster. It's in Las Vegas. Book five is another book from a different character's perspective. Agent Franks, he's one of the MCB agents. And yeah, just wow, love that one. Monster Hunter Siege, they decide to attack the city of monsters in Siberia. It is as cool as it sounds. From there, there's a short story collection, an anthology. A bunch of other authors wrote little short stories that fit into different places in the timeline, some as far back as the American Revolution, or in places as remote as Japan, and so on and so forth. And then there's an entire trilogy that was largely written by sci-fi powerhouse John Ringo. I've read a couple of his other books. I'll review them in future episodes. He read Monster Hunter International and just decided to write a whole trilogy of books set in that world and sent them to Larry. And Larry's like, heck yeah. So those ones are set in the 80s from another character's perspective. His name's Chad. He was a former Marine who gets recruited by MHI after he kills a whole ton of zombies. There's a pretty big tonal shift in this side trilogy called Monster Hunter Memoirs, mainly coming down to content issues. Larry Correa will write, you know, realistic action. There's some gore and violence and stuff because you're fighting monsters with machine guns and knives and whatever. And you know, he doesn't shy away from using, let's say, military caliber language. I wouldn't say he's over the top with it, but, you know, you get all the way up to the F-bomb and so forth. Ringo was a little bit more liberal with that. And on top of that, his main character, Chad, was, to put it bluntly, an absolute man whore. So you get a lot of Chad, you know, moving through girls while he's in between missions and jobs and stuff, which, you know, the world building that Ringo brings to it is fascinating, not just from the places, but the times. You know, he's in Seattle in the 80s. He's in New Orleans in the 80s. He goes out into the forest while he's doing some PT and rehabbing from some injuries and ends up running into a tribe of Sasquatches. Seattle gets taken over by gigantic spiders and nobody knows about it because of bureaucratic incompetence. And, you know, he's able to weave all these different ideas together, real world stuff with just absolutely out there fantasy stuff. And that stuff makes the side trilogy so strong. But there's also, you know, again, very frequent mentions of his whoredoms and lasciviousness, as it were. So just be aware of that. You guys know I do my content warnings. But that trilogy does tie in very well with the foundations of the main series. Last I checked, there is another book coming out in August in the main series that happens concurrently with the sixth book. There were events that ran together, but the sixth book is from Owen's point of view, so the seventh one will be from another character's point of view. Just an absolute fun, rip-roaring ride. It's hard to call it urban fantasy because there's not a whole lot of urban elements to it. It's mostly sci-fi, fantasy, people with guns, killing monsters and getting paid, but there's a solid overarching story. You feel, you know, very much that it's moving forward towards a big gnarly villain, a Thanos, as it were. Not that he's necessarily got the same motivations or mechanisms and stuff as Thanos, but they're fighting big, bad, ancient Lovecraftian evils in this series. And the thing that the glue that really keeps it all together is the individual characters, their motivations, their backstories, their cares. Like, you really want to make sure that they get out of it, that they all make it through. And there are times as you're reading, it's like, man, you're just not sure who's going to make it, but he's such a gripping writer that just you want to keep going. So Monster Hunter International, first book in the series, very much worth the read if the content is not an issue to you. And since, like I said, I want to break down a couple of different series for you, if I'm talking about a book that does have, you know, rougher content, let me look through my bookshelf and come up with one that is a little bit smoother around the edges for you. Aha, here we go. An absolute change of pace. Louis Sicard's The Card Turner. In 2003, there was that movie with the goofy kid from Even Stevens who would go on to become the no guy from Transformers, Shia LaBeouf. He was in a movie called Holes. It was about a bunch of kids that dig holes. The guy who wrote that book, Louis Sicard, also wrote this book. Reason I mention that is because when I first looked at the cover of this book, it was just a kid lying on a bench in probably a subway with a book over his face, and not entirely clear what the purpose was. When it says card turner, the A in card turner is the spade in a deck of cards. So I was like, okay, you know, it's Louis Sicard though. So I picked up a copy of it from the library, and in both style and substance, it blew my mind. So the premise is that there's a kid named Alton. He's got this rich, eccentric, sick uncle. I wouldn't say eccentric, rich uncle, who's got, you know, this uncle's Scrooge McDuck fortune that he's probably sitting on. And Alton's family really wants him to suck up to this uncle and, you know, be in the will and get the most money that they can. And they get a call one day that the uncle wants Alton to come be his eyes for a card game. The card game is Bridge. If you've heard of it, great. That's about as much as I knew about it when I first started reading this book. This book is equal parts a narrative as well as a lecture on the rules of the game of Bridge. I'd never played it, and I felt like I was pretty well versed in it by the time it ended. Sicard even mentions in either a foreword or an afterword that it was difficult to write because he became familiar with the game, and it was such a fascinating and interesting card game, and he found himself getting really caught up in watching other people play it. But there was a lot of, as it were, inside baseball, a lot of terminology, a lot of different plays that you can make with the cards. And you wouldn't grasp the excitement of it if you didn't understand any of it, how it works. So frequently the book will pause momentarily to explain a certain progression of moves or sequence of cards or ways that you play off of other people in the game. And he'll give you either a lengthy explanation of that, or just a brief one that sums it up. I have no idea how that would work on audio. I read it in print. That's how I recommend you read it. But anyway, Alton has to go be his uncle's eyes because his uncle's diabetic, didn't manage his health, went blind. But he is like this world-class bridge player. And so Alton has to learn the game of bridge, again, you know, for the benefit of the audience, for the reader, and find a way to, you know, tell his uncle what cards he has without telling the other players at the table, and then help him play. That is all that I want to say about it, because, again, I didn't know anything about this book when I walked in. It was like seeing a movie that you had never seen a single trailer for, and the movie was really, really good. This book is great. There is, you know, a multi-generational story to it that goes back to like the Eisenhower and Nixon administrations, where this uncle was friends with people who were friends with the president. They played bridge in high society circles, and there was romance, there was tragedy, there was injustice, things left unsaid, things left undone. And it all comes down to Alton and another girl named Teresa playing this game of bridge with his blinding, dying uncle. It is so much worth the process of discovery for you to pick up this book and read it and see how it works. In terms of content, I think there might have been one blasphemous utterance and maybe an A word in it one time. Other than that, pretty much it. It was just like the voice was, from what I recall, I read it back in 2011, accurate to a 16-year-old boy, without being, crude, crass, vulgar, any of that stuff. He captured the tone and the feeling of it very well. I think just the fact that it was so out there conceptually, a novel that teaches you how to play bridge, it might not have taken off as well as some of his other stuff, but I think in the end, I might enjoy it more than Holes. I've read Holes a couple of times more, and obviously it's a masterpiece of storytelling, and I'm really glad that Louis Sicard was able to write the screenplay, because the screenplay very closely mirrors the brilliance of the book. But The Card Turner by Louis Sicard, worth the read. Check it out, enjoy it, and let me know what you think. Dreadpennies@gmail.com. That's it for today. Tune back in on Wednesday for another book review episode, and of course, check Friday for another Tales from the Road. Thank you. Drive safe. See you out there.